the video, she's trying to get his right arm behind his back. So Sergeant A, Officer C are not sitting on him. Officer B is on his legs trying to keep from getting kicked again.
May I ask a question here? Because germane to this. So there was some discussion of the definition of restraint.
Yes.
And it sounds to me like there's a dispute here between the police and the CRC about whether or not this individual was restrained.
Correct.
What's your view again, and where do you see the difference between the CRC having heard their testimony?
And having listened to the CRC that night, I have no faith that if either Sergeant A or Officer C let go of the complainant's, either complainant's arm, that he was just going to put his arm behind his back and calmly be taken into custody for the incident in question. I believe he would have tried to either punch, based on previous actions of the complainant seconds earlier, either try to push up, get away, and still punch, or I think he would, if he could, try to get away from the officers. So I think he's taking steps forward to accomplish his task versus obeying commands and being taken into custody. I saw no indication that he was complying with the officers.
And you said this took place over a fairly quick period. I think you said 15-ish seconds, something.
A little bit longer than the whole length of the video you saw. Yeah.
So what should I expect if I am being tased some number of times greater than three? What's my state of mind? Am I in a position where I'm hearing what you're saying? I've never been tased, so I'm just asking the question. What would you expect in terms of compliance?
Sure. So when I was actually working the street, I have tased folks. Every time you activate the taser cycle, the officer has to reassess the effectiveness of that taser. After two drive-stun modes, if it's not working, you shouldn't do a third. I mean, you got some other tool needs to happen or different use of the taser. I have been tased. I've talked to many folks as I am trying to take them in custody. They're able to hear and comply if they so choose to.
You testified that the officer believed he used the taser three times, but the facts show it was deployed six times. Does that interfere with the argument you're making that there is a waiting period between those tasings to reassess the situation?
Yeah. The main issue with the number of tasings and where the discrepancy comes in, the first three tasings were 3 second, 1 second, and 1 second. They all occurred in a 5 second span of time. The way the taser measures, just to get a little bit technical, it won't measure anything less than 1 second. So if you have two half-second taser activations, they will both show as 1 second, and both of the 1 second taser activations happened during the same second, which I think it's fairly reasonable to assume that the officer is applying one, but his finger is kind of bouncing on the button a little bit as he is applying it for approximately 5 seconds.
Does that meet the standard then, 1 second, 1 second, 3 seconds? Does that meet the standard you're laying out in terms of reassessing before reapplying?
I think in this case, based on what the officer said, I think it's fair to assume that the officer did believe that this was only one activation. And during the struggle, like I said, his finger was coming off the button. This was a new piece of equipment, and I don't believe he knew that there were those gaps in there, thus believing that it was one single activation. So,
right. And you raised this testimony, so I'm asking it, even though it may not be especially germane. Is there training prior to sending new equipment out into the field?
Yes, there is.
What happened?
Well, one, I think in my mind, it's a poor design of that button on a taser. When you use a firearm and a taser is shaped like a firearm, you keep your finger out of the trigger guard. That's just basic weapon safety. It just so happens they call it indexing your finger. When you index your finger, it just so happens on this taser, that's where that button is. So during the video, when you see that flash go off in that drive stun mode, but the taser is not on the complainant, if you're struggling, you have a natural instinct to kind of clench your hands during that struggle. My assertion is when you do that, your finger's moving and you're bumping that taser. That's why I don't think the officer realized he was hitting that for a second at a time. That's why I think there's a discrepancy between the six activations, though again doesn't necessarily mean they're effective or on a complainant, and the officer's mind that there was that he thought he activated it and applied it three times.
But not surely not using a weapon in compliance with its instructions, that's a problem, isn't it?
Well, when you're trying to hold on to it, and if by holding on to it you're actually hitting that button, again, that's where I default back to the design. So when I took this position, and then when this case came to me, because it's gone through a couple different administrations and different people, I asked the training division, let's review this taser at large, because I think it's potentially problematic.
Even using it in a situation where that might happen is problematic. If you're struggling, because the CRC brief actually does say, witness A, Officer D, Sergeant A, restrained appellant's arms, knelt on his back, Officer B straddled appellant's legs. And I think that's what I saw in the video. Why would you then be using a taser in close quarters about that?
Because I think he was still struggling. They did not have control of him. And then I believe it was Commissioner Fish said, what other options would there be? I would rather have the officers use the taser with no residual effect versus any kind of a strike with their hands or knees or pulling out the ass baton and hitting them with a metal stick. I think that's problematic. If they punched him or used a metal stick, my question would be, why wouldn't you have used a taser? So I think the taser is a lesser probability of harm to anybody involved.
Can I pick back up on the question of the taser? In terms of a piece of equipment, Chief, how many times can it be discharged?
That specific taser, the taser itself? Yeah. So this new taser, like the one used in this incident, it has two separate probe cartridges.
It's the so-called X2 taser.
Yes. So it has two cartridges with two cartridges, and each cartridge has two probes. So you can fire the two cartridges independently of one another. But for the drive stun mode, where you're not discharging anything, it's just a contact mode. There's a number of times. There is, it could just cycle and cycle and cycle. So it's two different ways to use that electronic control device.
And do we currently have any guidelines that deal with the frequency of use?
Yes, in our patrol tactics, if you use that. Well, since that weapon specifically is what we're talking about, if you use it in drive stun mode a couple times and you're not getting a desired effect, excuse me, the officer should be thinking through each one and realize what they're trying to do isn't working and reassess on what they could do to, in this case, effectively take somebody into custody. So they need to be always kind of reassessing and reassessing what they're trying to accomplish, and whatever tactic they're using, is it effective? If it isn't, they better be thinking differently on how to do something that will be effective.
Can you explain the two different modes of use with probes and without? I also have never been tased, so.
Yeah, so I apologize up front if it's a little technical. So you have two modes. You have a drive stun mode. So, excuse me. The end of it's maybe an inch by 2 inches, roughly, and it's just a contact. So, if I place it against somebody's arm and touch that little button for a second, they'll have that contact for a second. It's going to hurt their arm. You pull it away, zero residual impact of that. Doesn't affect the rest of their body at all. So, it's lesser level of control, if you will. The second way to use it is if you have some distance, you can discharge two probes and actually make contact with you. So I could hypothetically hit like a forearm and an upper arm. Those two probes where that contact is where you get that electricity through. That effectively isolates the larger muscles just in the arm, and it's harder to use your arm. But the rest of you is still free to do what you choose. And yes, it hurts. I mean, I've been tased. As soon as that electricity stops, you have no residual, full motion, game on again.
Excuse me, though. This yes. That what you just said is not in the record, right? That's not part of the evidence for this hearing.
He was. The officer did use probes.
Description of how a taser works. Because I know that there are people who would dispute that as to it's possible for residual effects and that it's not as benign as you just characterized, but that's not what, and in either case, it's not what we're discussing today, is it?
Yeah, a whole detailed account of how the taser works and the whole taser training, none of that's in an internal affairs review. That's correct.
I just was wanting to understand the difference between the two because of the escalation. It sounds like an escalation to deploy probes.
Yes.
So there was a choice to escalate in the final application, I guess.
Is the probes.
Is the probes.
Correct.
Okay. And the complainant, he was being apprehended because of his perceived aggressive behavior, not necessarily what may or may not have transpired with the driver earlier. Is that?
Yes, his interactions with the driver initially, correct.
But, I mean, if he had just not seemed aggressive at all, would he still have been taken into custody?
Well, if he wasn't aggressive at all, I mean, I'd still expect the sergeant and the officers to contact him and try to figure out what happened, if anything, between the complainant, well, the person in the car,
yeah,
and the complainant in this case, try to figure out what happened. And then if he was, in my opinion, not resistive, and they could have had a conversation, who knows how it would have ended up.
Okay. Thank you.
Mayor, I have one more question, and then I hope we have a chance to bring the chair of the CRC back.
Absolutely. You bet.
Chief, could you provide just a little more description for us of what you believe is the critical distinction between active aggression and resisting arrest? So where's that line? And help us understand the difference.
Well, the way we teach officers, and I'll just read it for you again. So out of our directive at the time that this case occurred, so it's active aggression is a threat or overt act of an assault, and again, through physical or verbal means, coupled with a present ability to carry out the threat or assault, which reasonably indicates an assault or injury is imminent. So active aggression. So somebody, I'm trying to think of a hypothetical for you. I mean, if somebody, you know, has clenched fists or sweating, they're running away, and they say, "Hey, come, you know, I need to talk to you," and they don't, but they turn and they're clenched and they're looking for different ways of escape, and they might verbally say, "Get away from me, I'm not gonna be taken into custody," and they're tense and clenched. Approaching that person is a whole lot different than I've talked to other folks, you know, "Hey, you're under arrest," and they go, "Okay," and they actually turn around and put their hands behind their back. I mean, they're two wholly different scenarios to where, based on their verbal comments, if any, their body stance, if any, the situation at hand, you know, what the person in the car stated happened, you have all those together, and that builds up to where, you know, in your mind, would this person potentially be violent or not? And if they, like the directive states that we train people, if you think they're going to be actively aggressive, you can go up to that level. My assertion in this case, though, with the video, is on the ground kicking an officer off him, to me, is actively aggressive, or pushing up, trying to not be taken into custody and trying to get away from the officers. To me, that's an overt act that you're not complying. I apologize that it's not a bright line on or off. I mean, there is a sliding scale, if you will, in there. But I think on this case, getting kicked as an example, to me, that's clear cut.
I'd like to ask a question about the police bureau's finding. Exonerated, but with a debriefing. Can you explain that in layman's terms? What does that mean exactly?
Sure. I think it's on one of the footnotes I sent with my statement, but exonerated is, so unfounded would be just didn't even happen. Exonerated is it happened, but debriefing is these kinds of cases, I would always suggest debriefing because I think you can always learn from everything. So debriefing is a discussion. Sit down with all the parties and discuss why'd you do what you do at what time and go through it and relive it and debrief it. What could you have done better? Other options you could have used. So just saying, yes, your actions were within policy. I think it's always beneficial to have a debriefing of what I just stated. Even, I mean, on all these, frankly, I mean, I always think it's good to sit down and reassess actions on any incident of this nature. So that excuse me, that added notation of with debriefing is just this, that the officer, the sergeant, and their command sitting down and essentially kind of going over what we're doing here today.
So without bias, I'm just going to ask the following question. Would it be fair to say that the finding is, from your perspective, he acted within Bureau policy, but it was sloppy?
No, I would say it's he acted within policy, but it's good for all three of those members and their command to sit down and go, and with each one, why'd you do what you did? Could you approach it differently? You know, that was a tool being tested at the time. What can you learn from that? There's all, you know, I can't think of any situation to where you can't learn and do a better job. Even if it goes well, you can always do better, right? I mean, that's kind of my philosophy. So it doesn't hurt to sit down and debrief. So I wouldn't say in policy, but sloppy.
Would you say that it was within policy, but not textbook?
That's more subjective. I mean, in policy, but not in textbook. I think Sergeant B, all his actions were exonerated. I think he did what he was trained to do. Having him try to take control of the complainant with three people, I think that's appropriate, and that's textbook. When you get kicked, you go back and help the other officers and try to trap his leg so he doesn't kick you again. I think that's textbook. So
bear with me for one more question, colleagues. I appreciate this. I'm just trying to make sure I understand the totality.
There's a lot to this.
Okay, so there's we're talking about a 15-second period.
Right.
And it is your contention that this individual, you know, we're really talking about Officer B, that Officer B used their judgment over that 15-second period and was within Bureau policy.
Yes, I believe he was.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can the act of tasing produce the reflex that you, or was perceived as aggression on behalf of the complainant?
No, it would not.
So the involuntary kicking or anything like that would not be a reaction to being tased?
No. One of the big issues, and I saw it on TV last night, TV movies, somebody gets tased and they pass out. I mean, it's just horrific. It's just, that's not what happens. I've been tased where it went through my whole body, and you lock your large muscle groups lock up, and you don't move. Once it stopped, again, zero residual. I can get up and go instantly. So the involuntary motor motions of, like, kicking, like you saw in the video, would not occur.
Again, I do think that could be have other evidence. But I don't see anywhere in the TASER policy where it says how often it may be discharged in a minute or in 5 minutes. Is it in a different part than the policy?
Oh, how often a person could...
Well, yeah, I've got policy 1051.00, electronic control weapon system. And it says when it may be used, but it doesn't say anything about how often. Is there another policy that says you should not use it more than X times in a minute?
No. There's not a policy that says you shouldn't use it more than X times in a minute. But the current policy is if you use it three times, like was used in this case, the new policy states that triggers a whole other set of protocols, but we don't have for our various tools. We have how many times per minute an officer can use them. We just don't approach it that way. Again, on this one, if you try the drive stun twice, it's not effective twice. you should be thinking something different, whether that takes 30 seconds or 3 minutes or 3 seconds.
Which really goes to the mayor's point in that was used many times, more than three.
Well, again, my assertion is even though it was recorded, the computer chip in the taser was recorded, I believe that, again, if you watch the video and you see that bright light and that taser is up in the air, that's that drive stun mode. I believe the officer's inadvertently hitting that button because that's where his finger is out of the trigger guard. And yes, it's being activated, but I don't think it's necessarily, in my opinion, it's not a contact with a complainant. That's why I believe the officer thinks he did it three times instead of what the taser download computer chip reads as six activations. He has six activations, but the officer is thinking he actually had contact with the subject three times.
And that seems to conflict with some of the witnesses, not the police witnesses, but the civilian witnesses. Report more than three. Maybe I can clarify that with the CRC. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for the chief? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Can we invite the chair of the CRC up for a minute, Mayor?
Yes, please. Come on up.
And while we're waiting for the chair, I have a question for counsel. Mayor read some instructions at the beginning of the hearing and analogized this to a land use hearing. And I guess we're all waiting for him to say, does anyone have any ex parte contacts to disclose? Does that not apply to this proceeding?
I'll refer to Heidi, but I believe the answer is no in this case. Heidi?
Yeah, she's checking.
Oh, thanks.
Because that's part of the instructions we get in land use, so I just want to make sure we understand what the rules are.
Could you speak into the microphone, please?
So the advice from council is that
you need to push the button because the voice just push it and let it go.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, good. You got the one that doesn't work.
There it goes. Good.
Sorry, I thought green was going. So then the question regarding ex parte communication would be that if you've had ex parte communication regarding this matter, you would disclose the fact of such ex parte communication, not the details thereof. And then you would disregard any of that information and state that you will disregard that information for purposes of consideration of your ruling and decision.
And when do we do that, at the end of the hearing?
Yes, I think that would be appropriate at the end of the hearing to do that.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Commissioner.
Prior to making your decision on it.
Very good. Thank you.
Oh, Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
There are 11 members of the CRC, correct? Under your bylaws, what is a quorum?
Five.
And so the 4-1 vote would then meet the quorum requirement.
Correct.
Is that a sufficient quorum in your judgment? 5 out of 11?
I don't know that it's ideal, but for 11 volunteers, I think that's probably the lowest possible number that would seem fair.
But wasn't this heard when you only had 9? We've recently increased it to 10.
We had 9 several years ago before I joined. We've been at 11 since I joined, but for a period of time, we were short a couple members while we awaited recruitment.
Thank you.
Second question I have for you is, in reviewing the voluminous record that we got on this, one of the things that struck me was the number of times this came back to the CRC and the number of sort of procedural hiccups along the way. And I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that because this has taken a very long time to come to us. There were some back and forth about what's the right directive and was it being applied, and could you offer some advice and guidance to us about the procedural history of this case and what we can learn from that?
Sure. I think this case has become kind of the poster child for delays with the CRC process. Not long ago, City Council kind of commissioned a focus group to work on expediting CRC appeals, and the complainant was actually part of that group and provided some of his own opinions. But I think that this case is a really good example from the CRC's perspective of how much of that timing is out of the CRC's control. I think if you will look at the reasons this came back and back again, the Bureau, in our opinion, and I think rightly so, didn't complete an investigation. We had additional questions about the taser log as well as witnesses that weren't interviewed that the Bureau did then go back and re-interview. But they're supposed to have 10 days to do that, and it took much longer than that. Then we convened for an appeal, and it was the Bureau who didn't show. The volunteers were present and ready to hear the appeal, but the Bureau members were under instructions not to attend. And then we went through a whole appeal hearing under the wrong directive, which was selected and evaluated by the Bureau. And although there was some complaint about that during that appeal hearing, the kind of verdict we received from the city attorney and the Bureau was that it was the right directive, only several days later to discover that the appellant was correct and that the case had originally been evaluated under the wrong directive. And then additional time is taken when we disagree with the Bureau, because there's a kind of procedure for us to meet again with Chief Marchman and see if through dialogue we can agree on a disposition that would prevent us from coming here.
And you did, in fact, on one of the two issues, get to a disposition.
We did. But on this final complaint, it proceeded to you, and that kind of conference process of having another meeting to talk with the chief about it after we've already made our decision elongates the time as well.
Well, I would say that these kinds of cases don't come to the council very often, and I was struck by the procedural history, and I think we have to be very careful about the demands that we make on citizen members of committees like this and the amount of time and energy goes into these cases, and we have to find a way to do this in a more expedited way and in a way that I think just has a more common sense. I felt your pain as I was going through the record of the procedural history of the case. The chief was just before us, and I guess probably a number of us are now a little confused about what is the standard of review. And we are now been told there might be a difference of opinion on that. What's your view?
My understanding, and I think my understanding of what the chief was trying to get at was that our committee and you all are supposed to be fairly deferential to the finding reached by the Bureau. They get a preponderance of the evidence standard, so they're kind of a more probable than not, was this within policy? Whereas you and I have to evaluate on whether that finding was a reasonable one, which is, it gives you less license to insert your own opinion. And I think what Chief Marchman was talking about was pointing out that there were several other players in the review process who, using the more generous standard of review, had also concurred with what the Bureau's finding was. So I think it's fairly well settled that supported by the evidence or the reasonable person standard is what you all are supposed to be using.
Even if we were to disagree with the ultimate judgment.
Yes.
Could I ask a question related to that, Commissioner, unless you had other
questions? That's it. Thank
questions.
You.
So the chief showed us a number of very grainy videos, and it is the contention of the police bureau in their findings that the individual was not restrained and was engaged in active aggression, and he pointed out some points in the video where he said, you know, the individual was actively avoiding being arrested. He knocked an officer over. He was trying to do push-ups or whatever. What's your comeback to that?
I think that the we had an interesting insight into this particular directive because we reviewed the wrong directive first, and when we reviewed under the wrong directive, we agreed with the Bureau, mostly because we felt that that directive allowed the taser to be used in the case where someone was trying to flee or resist or be somewhere less than what it is now, which active aggression, I think we need to focus on the definition in the directive, which is a threat or overt act of assault. And I think that listening to the chief say it, there is, to him, restrained, meaning completely passive and calm. The officers could have gotten up off of him, and he would have laid there passively. And assaulting somebody, and in between that, I think, is where the CRC found that he was resisting, but that resisting was not active aggression. And I think when you look at the kicking, in light of the video that you all watched, the kicking occurs right as he falls to the ground. He's been tased, and he's kind of flailing. But then in order to apply the drive stun to the calf of the appellant, Officer B has to get hold of his legs, and he's holding the one leg down, which is kind of crossing over his body in a way that is really pinning him to the ground, and he goes into the calf. And then when he goes to deploy the probes, at that point he's straddling, and he's got a knee on him, and Sergeant A is straddling, and it looks like he's almost asking the other officers to make sure they move out of the way so that he can deploy the probes and not hit them. That, to me, is what appears on the video.
So after several years of reviewing this, it sounds like you're saying, yes, he was resisting arrest, but he was not engaged in active aggression. And you know, what we're hearing from the officer involved is he felt there was a threat. I think the police chief said it looked, you know, to him, like somebody might throw a punch. There's some grainy videos that would probably make the worst hits of YouTube if they were put out there under a standard. What advice would you give this body, given that the standard that we are required to act under is, could a reasonable individual have made this decision based on the evidence that's available? What advice would you give us as the CRC chair?
I would say first that I think the community especially has been concerned locally and nationally over officers' subjective accounts of fears or threats of assault. And when you see the video here, I think that that's very good evidence that the subject was, in fact, restrained at the time. And I personally would look to the last discharge of the taser. I think we heard Chief Marchman talk a lot about discharges in the air, and maybe some of the activations in the middle didn't come into contact with the appellant. But we know that the sixth discharge occurred after he had deployed the probes. So anything that's coming from that taser is going directly down these wires and into the appellant. And it seems pretty undisputed to me that he had no justification for that activation, that it was simply an accident resulting from the design of this new taser that caused him to flick the button completely inadvertently.
So the video does appear to show some flashes. What do you think that means? The chief gave one thought in terms of what he thought that meant. What does it mean to you, if anything? And it doesn't have to be anything.
I don't know, from my perspective, that it changes the analysis much. We know that there was a drive stun when he was standing and that he fell. We know that there was a drive stun in the calf when he was on the ground. We know that there was a probe deployed into his back. And those three activations are not disputed. We know that they occurred, and we know that they made contact with the appellant. And at least before this hearing, we had not heard the Bureau dispute that the last activation occurred while the probes were still attached before the medical personnel came and removed them from his back.
So he was, according to you, resisting arrest. 15 seconds go by where some number of charges are deployed directly to the complainant. I think in his testimony he said at least three times. So we're disputing the number of times, aren't we?
I think it's, to me, it's clear that there's a minimum of four. There are the three that the officer reported and the one while the wires were attached that showed up on the taser log.
Okay.
So
okay.
Whether or not those two were in the air, four to six, I think, is probably what we can say from the log and the video.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Do you have any other comments on any of the questions that have come forward and maybe things that the CRC discussed?
I can clarify for you, witness officers C and D. witness officer D is actually the partner of officer B. For some reason, the order got swapped. Witness officer C was the officer who contacted the driver of the vehicle. So that officer's statement concerned her report of what happened around the car. That was not an officer that was standing around watching the incident on the video transpire.
And was there any discussion in the CRC of the initial use of force, attempting to put this person in handcuffs?
I believe there was related to another allegation, but I didn't refresh on that for this meeting. And I would suspect that if it did come up that there was significant evidence that the appellant was putting his hands into his pockets and throwing things on the ground. I think the appellant said that he wanted to show his driver's license to prove who he was and that he wasn't homeless. But Sergeant A was worried that there was a weapon or something like that in the pockets, and there wasn't a response.
And we've heard lots of discussion about the standard of review and the reasonable person versus preponderance of the evidence. Based on that knowledge, how often does the CRC have a majority saying that, yes, there is a reasonable person would not have done that or concluded that?
I wouldn't say it happens terribly often. There have been times where we've tried to add a debriefing where something happened maybe in line with what Mayor Wheeler was saying, where, you know, this was within policy, but it was sloppy. You know, this was not the ideal way that we would like to handle this. And then we've had a couple occasions where we have challenged and the Bureau has accepted our challenge, either without a conference hearing or after some dialogue with the Bureau, we've come to see eye to eye.
I had one follow-up, and since we've never had a hearing like this before, I just want to say that I appreciate that you and your role as the chair of the CRC are playing an invaluable role in helping the council understand the CRC's position and walk us through it. We're sort of making this up as we go along, but I appreciate the very much your presentation. The chief, toward the end of his presentation, talked a little bit about the higher use of force. And as I understand the argument, is that it may have been, in the context of what was going on, might have been a different case if someone had used a baton or a fist, that, in fact, it was just a taser. And I want to think about that, but what was your reaction to that?
I would say six of the new CRC members 2 years ago had an opportunity to attend the Citizens Police Academy, and the officers there who had been tased during their training, I think they can voluntarily elect to be tased to see what it's like, almost all said it's an experience they would never want to repeat. And I am not sure I am as persuaded by the concept of it being brief or it not leaving a mark when talking about the amount of pain experienced or the kind of trauma it can leave behind. But I am not sure that from the evidence we saw that an escalation in force was needed. It seemed like especially once the subject was on the ground, the officers were in the process of getting the appellant under control. I think perhaps time would have been the best remedy there. I wonder if the officer B had evaluated the situation before he deployed the probes. He might have seen that there wasn't much of an out for the appellant anymore at that point in time, and it was just a matter of time before they got his hands together and could proceed.
I apologize. I'm not sure if you are the right person to address this question to, but the complainant has indicated that he's a traumatic brain injury survivor and that he experiences mental illness. And in the last several years, I know police policy and training has changed around interacting with individuals experiencing mental illness. This situation escalated quickly. Clearly, the complainant appeared to be afraid and perhaps panicked, based on emptying his pockets, asking what he had done, saying he wasn't homeless. I can imagine why he said that. Can you comment at all on what we would hope or expect an officer to do when encountering someone who may be experiencing some kind of crisis or just ongoing mental illness?
The CRC has convened a work group and had voted recently to support a report that would prioritize de-escalation whenever possible. I think that the concept of de-escalation we've seen has kind of appears sporadically through police policy, but cities like Seattle have an overarching policy emphasizing de-escalation, and I would hope that with a more de-escalation-based policy, you would not see the officers escalating the situation so quickly. I think that there might have been a better way to back off instead of advance and go immediately to force. I don't think that that decision at the time was out of policy, but there's a policy that we wish we had and a policy that we have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions of this panel or anybody else? So, colleagues, we have had at least one commissioner ask that we go into executive session to meet with legal counsel. And I set a standard earlier that if anybody felt that that was an important thing, that we would do that. We will come back into open session, obviously. But for the time being, we are did you have a question?
I believe your city attorney, David Landrum, needs to disclose ex parte communication policy.
So why don't we do this now? Okay, sir. Why don't we do this now so we take care of this council, which is the decision-making body. I will ask legal counsel, if you'll give me a moment. Legal counsel, we are going to, in a moment, disclose any ex parte contacts we have had. Is there a commensurate requirement that city attorney disclose their ex parte contacts?
My understanding, what I hear Mr. Klug talking about would be an interaction that happened related to the civil case. That matter is not before this council and is not part of your consideration for this issue of whether you find evidence to support the chief's finding in this situation. So that particular would be a separate issue unrelated to what's before you today.
All right. Thank you.
Mayor, I'll kick it off.
Please.
We received a couple of emails relating to this matter. I believe one was from the complainant, and I did not review that email, just forwarded it on to my staff person. I had a brief conversation with Dan Handelman, who is something of a historian of police accountability matters, and he reminded me we've not had such a hearing since 2003. And that was largely the extent of it.
I received the email also from the complainant, which I did read.
Excuse me, sir. You're out of order. Let us finish this order of business, because you are the complainant. I will let you address the council, but for the time being, let us do our business here. I have no ex parte contacts except the email that was referenced earlier. I did read the email.
Same. I received the email. I read the first paragraph, then realized it was relating to this, and so I waited till I could ask the city attorney as to whether I was supposed to be reading it. I also meet regularly with Julie Ramos, who's the co-chair of the CRC. I haven't been meeting with her since I knew this was going to be on the council agenda, so we certainly haven't discussed the specifics in this case, although when it first came through, it may have been one of the ones that she talked to me about in general.
Commissioner Udaly.
I received the email but did not read it and have had no other communications about this case.
Very good. So the City Council has made its disclosure, sir. If you wanted to come up.
Do you know anything about the communication?
Could you please reintroduce yourself for the
record? My name is Matthew Klug.
Thank you.
And I'm just curious if you guys have any clue about the communication I sent. Because if you didn't read it, there's a big problem. the Tort Review Board wanted to get to the bottom of my complaint in federal court, District Court of Oregon. And inside the District Court of Oregon complaint was the video that I received from a civil rights attorney here in town.
So I've got
the video with audio. So it would be beneficial to look at the copy the Tort Review Board was interested in get to the bottom of.
So here's the problem, sir, with regard to this hearing. We are not allowed to entertain new evidence. We are unable to do that.
No, that was the evidence.
I will ask the city attorney whether or not we are allowed to consider new evidence.
You are not allowed to consider new evidence. You are allowed to consider the evidence that was in the record at the time.
Correct.
The video was in the record at the time.
The video is in the record. The copy of the video that's in the record is running on the internet at klug.pw. It is very visible. It's not cloudy and choppy like the copy they have. It has audio. It would be beneficial to look at the copy that the Tort Review Board was interested in reviewing at the Internal Affairs and Independent Police Review. Otherwise, we've got the policy. And to answer Amanda's question, the number is in 2.4. It's on the second page. And then the first charge of the taser at 3.8 was up in my face. So in the written report from the cop, in the narrative, it says warning arc. There's nothing in training about a warning arc. And then you see me fall to the ground, and if you watch the video and my good copy on the internet,
okay,
I cover my face. This is all in the record.
I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I have to give everybody...
It's 30 seconds long, too. But six charges of the taser go off. They're limited to 5 seconds each.
So that's 30 seconds.
I can't allow you to continue.
I'm sorry.
But that's the video.
It's the basis of the whole thing.
City Attorney, that version of the video is in the record.
I'm not sure of what Mr. Klug is referencing. There is a version of the video that is in the record that I'm sure we could get and make available to you. I don't know what Mr. Klug is referring to, and I haven't seen it, so I can't say.
I think that is germane to what we have to decide. We have to decide whether a reasonable person, considering the evidence, could make a decision.
The one with audio.
That part of the evidence. And thank you, Mr. Klug, for telling me, in fact, that yes, in 2.4, it does say members should evaluate their force options and give consideration to other force options if a ECW is not effective after two cycles on the same person.
Okay, we gave the complainant approximately 2 extra minutes, and for that reason, if the Portland Police Bureau would like 2 extra minutes in the interest of fairness, I will offer that.
Back to the ex parte thing, though.
Excuse me, sir.
May I address the
council? Sir, you're out of order. No, you may not.
Mayor, in the packet of materials that we were given in advance of this hearing, we were given a DVD. And as I understand it, is the DVD of the video in question. Is that correct?
Of audio.
I believe that's right, but I think IPR put the package together, and we could double-check with them. But I believe that is correct, that is the CD that has the video in it with everything on it that was considered as part of the record.
Okay. And the police bureau has declined the extra 2 minutes. Is that correct? Okay, good. So we will now adjourn into executive session. We will be back. So we are in recess.
One moment. You need to read the script regarding going in.
I'm sorry, I forgot a script that I'm supposed to read. Thank you.
Landrum calling me personally. I mean, I'd love to discuss.
Okay,
that.
So here is the script. The City Council will now adjourn to the Mayor's Conference Room to meet in executive session pursuant to ORS 192.6602B, which allows City Council to meet in executive. Just wallow through this, which allows the City Council to meet in executive session to consider the dismissal or disciplining of or to hear complaints or charges brought against a public employee who has not requested an open hearing and pursuant to ORS 192.6602F, which allows the City Council to meet in executive session to consider information or records exempt by law from public inspection. Representatives of the news media and designated staff shall be allowed to attend the executive session. Representatives of the news media are specifically directed not to report on or otherwise disclose any of the deliberations or anything said about these subjects during the executive session, except to state the general subject of the session as previously announced. No decision may be made in executive session. At the end of the executive session, the council will return to the open session in council chambers. The city attorney wanted to speak?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Please introduce your name for the, yourself.
Mark
for the
Ambert
record.
With the city attorney's office.
Thank you.
The procedural point, ORS 192-6602B, one of the bases for going into executive session allows the involved employee, the officer in this case, to request that the executive session be held in open session. And I've had a communication with the representative for the officer, and the officer does not want to have the matter deliberated in open session. So I
very good.
Need to state that for the
record. Okay, thank you. So we are in recess.
Can we get that DVD in place? I don't know.